The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. It seems like every day there's some new health controversy. Just in the last week, I've read articles about Wi-Fi, cell phones, power lines, and green cleaning products. And interestingly, only one of those seems to show any evidence of posing an actual health hazard. Today, we're going to take on two health controversies and try to figure out exactly what we should be legitimately concerned about. I'm in the studio with Dr. Mark McKenzie, medical physicist at the Cross Cancer Institute, who is not in any way speaking for the Cross Cancer Institute. And I have many, many questions about the backscatter scanners that are now being used in U.S. airports. Thanks for being here, Mark.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you and I did an entire episode on health and radiation way back in episode 37, and we didn't touch on this topic, not only because it wasn't a thing at that point, but was this technology in use?
I don't believe it was even in use. Right now, the Security Administration in the U.S. has deployed, I think as of the end of November, about 400 scanners throughout the U.S. And they're hoping by the end of 2011, I think it is, they're projecting to have 1,000 scanners out in airports. So this is something that's just been exploding. It's new. And that's, I guess, why we didn't talk about it, because it just wasn't even a thing.
So then what was being used a year ago?
Well, I mean, we obviously have got the baggage scanning units, which are essentially X-ray units, relatively similar to the diagnostic units that you would see. And that would be for scanning, you know, personal effects, not for scanning people. People scanning is a new phenomenon.
So maybe start out by explaining how the backscatter scanner works.
Right. So as you get to lower and lower X-ray energies, you tend to get more and more of your X-ray interactions occurring as backscattered photons. There's a physicist in the early 20th century, Thompson, and that's sort of the classical X-ray scattering that you tend to see. It's Thompson scattering. And it tends to be a little more isotropic, which is to say it occurs forward and backward almost in equal amounts. As you get to higher and higher energies, most of the scatter occurs in a forward direction. And that's, I guess, not what they're looking for. They're looking to scan an X-ray beam over the patient, because normally you do this with, you know, in a hospital setting, over the passenger. And then you would look at the backscattered X-rays and build up a picture of the surface topography. Now, there's not going to be a lot of attenuation of those X-rays through, say, the clothes that you're wearing. That's going to be relatively radio translucent. But as soon as you get to the skin, a lot of that stuff's going to be scattering back, and then you'll get a surface scan, essentially.
So you're saying there is a difference from an X-ray?
Well, I mean, you're using actually X-rays that are... And here's the tricky thing. This is a fairly new technology, and I've been trying to find out what energies are being used. And there isn't a lot in the literature. There isn't much even available as public documents online. And I've seen actually three numbers. I've seen 28 kVp, which is kilovoltage potential. So you're accelerating electrons through a 28,000 kilovolt potential, hitting a target and creating X-rays from that. So I've seen 28 kVp, 50 kVp, and 100 kVp. All of those are fairly typical diagnostic energy levels. It's funny, you do actually get some transmission. In fact, CT scanners, which are supposed to be doing whole body scanning, operate at 125, 150 kVp. So really, you can actually get transmission through the body. It's not just backscatter. This stuff is actually passing right through the body, although that's not how it appears to be getting used in this case. As you get to lower and lower energy, you're going to get less transmission through the body and more of that energy being deposited on the skin. And when I say, as another clarification, 28 or 50 or 100 kVp, that's the peak energy of the beam. Most of the energy is going to be somewhere about half to a third of that energy. That's going to be sort of the peak of the X-rays. But it's going to be a whole spectrum of low-energy stuff and high-energy stuff. Low-energy stuff preferentially getting stopped really right at the skin level, you know, within micrometers. and the higher energy stuff blasting on through in some percentage.
Well, maybe let's do a little bit of a comparison here. We have a question from the website. How does the radiation emitted by the backscatter X-ray compare with the dose of natural radiation that passengers get when flying at 30,000 feet?
That's a number that's been bandied about a lot. Normally, when we measure radiation for radiation protection purposes, we usually measure it in something called millisieverts. So just a unit. Milla meaning, you know, 1/1000th of a sievert, which is it's an effective, essentially a joule per kilogram of energy. Now, a millisievert, 2 millisieverts, that's typical background radiation. When you're flying in a plane, the typical number that gets thrown around is about 10 microsieverts. So that would be 0.01 millisieverts per hour. So that's not a lot. And the scanner manufacturer likes to throw out that the amount of radiation you're getting from their scanning the backscatter device is about 1/30th of that. So in other words, they say that you get the equivalent dose from the backscatter in about 2 minutes of flying. And so that's a number that's thrown out there. That being said, I don't think I've seen any measurements on this. Sometimes they're talking also about effective whole body dose, and there are such things as tissue weighting factors. So when you calculate an effective whole body dose, you often throw on weighting factors for different organs. So the skin dose may actually be higher, so the dose at skin. And that's what has some people concerned, is that the lowest energy X-rays tend to be absorbed completely in the skin. And if they're quoting whole body effective doses, well, isn't the dose at skin higher still? I haven't actually run through the calculation or actually seen any good numbers on that, so I can't even tell you how much higher the skin dose is. That being said, I don't want to panic anybody because we're still talking about incredibly low doses. But, I mean, it's a complicated thing. We're also talking about instantaneous dose versus time dose over time. So we really don't know what the effect of this is necessarily going to be. So I'd like to see more study and more information. I don't think there's quite enough information, quite enough study. That being said, I don't think it's something that people should necessarily panic over, but I don't like seeing radiation-emitting devices, especially ionizing radiation. And as you know, I've actually been on the news a couple times recently talking about microwaves and wireless technology and cell phones. That's non-ionizing radiation. It doesn't break the bonds of molecules or atoms. It doesn't ionize electrons out of their shell. And therefore, non-ionized radiation, we think is pretty safe. And that actually is in the domain of, there's a different kind of scanner. There's the backscatter scanner, and then there's the millimeter wave scanners. They actually use radio frequencies instead. And that should be, from all we know about our studies on radio waves and health, should be safe. The ionizing radiation, it feels like it's being rolled out as part of, an attempt to get some kind of appearance of security. And again, I love the expression kabuki security. You know, it looks like it's the security theater. You're going through all the show of look how much we're doing, and nobody's even addressed other things that some potential failings of this technology.
Well, that's one of the things I'm wondering, because we do hear a lot of these comparisons between just flying by itself or to the X-rays. So, first of all, are those appropriate comparisons in the first place?
Well, there are definitely some differences. So we're talking about dose rate, energy levels. So when you're talking about flying at height, what sort of energy spectrum are you being subjected to? What's the particle types that you're being subjected to? Some radiation types we actually know are more damaging. And that's actually why we talk about doses in sieverts, because there are weighting factors for different kinds of radiations. Neutrons, definitely more biologically damaging than X-rays or electrons. So, yeah, there are differences. It's not exactly a fair comparison. I think it's just a number that they can sort of throw out and say, this is technically true. Although, again, I haven't seen the direct measurements. I would love to see some sort of QA program on these devices where people are wearing dosimeters, things that record radiation doses at skin, and, you know, they would do a regular QA program, make sure these things are operating as they're supposed to, and giving out the appropriate radiation doses. It troubles me a little bit that this is ionizing radiation being used routinely on a large population without necessarily high-level training for the staff, which I'd like to see more of. I don't know what sort of quality assurance program there is on the machines to make sure that they're always operating at the radiation level that's intended, and to make sure that there's, you know, no potential trouble. I believe these machines are using a raster scan, which is to say the source scans back and forth over the patient at different levels, kind of like the way your TV screen used to paint your picture on one line at a time. So it's scanning one line at a time, like a printer. And it's unclear, you know, what the quality assurance is on the mechanics of it. Presumably there are interlocks, but I don't know how they test the interlocks. So a fail-safe for if the device breaks down in any way. Is there some sort of interlock that would come on and stop the machine from operating? These things I don't know. And these are questions I think the traveling public has a right to ask. Should people be concerned? I don't think people need to panic. It's not a lot of radiation dose, but that being said, I'm not sure it's even worth it. There's something called the ALARA principle, you know, getting things as low as reasonably achievable, taking into account societal and economic factors. And though that's one of the key parts here is the societal factor. Is it worth it? You know, are we doing something that's really necessary? And I'm not sure it is necessary. So that's not really even a physics issue. That's not necessarily even a health issue. That's taking a step back and saying, why are we doing this? And I can almost hear a cash register cha-chinging in the background.
So how has this been tested? Because again, all I hear is the comparisons. But have these machines been tested?
From what I've seen, the TSA say they've gone through a testing process. Again, I don't know a lot of the details on what they've done and what they've found. I would like to see more independent testing. It's one thing to say that we've tested the machine. It's another thing to say that we've put the machine out there and had others look at it, test it, examine it. I don't think the TSA wants to actually give out machines for just willy-nilly testing, because maybe they see that as being a security issue. That being said, I would like to see more independent groups taking a look at these machines, looking at the radiation dose, looking at the safety of them. And again, stepping back and speaking as just a concerned citizen, I would have to ask, why are we even doing this?
Well, even issues like you're talking about prolonged exposure. So I realize that we don't have testing on this, but if we do use those things like x-rays as comparators, do frequent flyers have more of a risk?
It's not necessarily about the frequent flyers. I mean, again, I would have to go back and say this is a really ostensibly low dose. I'd like to see, again, more study on that to see how low the dose really is, especially at skin. But it is a really low dose. Even if, say, we're out by a factor of 10 on the radiation dose, that 2-minute dose equivalent to flying becomes 20 minutes dose equivalent to flying. I can't imagine many people are doing short hauls that are under an hour. And so you could be a fairly frequent flyer and your radiation dose is not going to be that high compared to the flying itself. And you're looking at higher doses still from even regular medical procedures that you might get. You might not really think about it, but yeah, when you go to the dentist and you get those bite wings, or you get even a panoramic, you know, those are fairly much higher dose procedures. So we get those fairly regularly and we don't really think about it. In fact, those are probably fairly fair comparisons, because we're talking about energies that are really, for the x-rays, on the same level. Where we're talking about instantaneous dose rates, which are much higher. So actually, that's probably not a bad comparison, is to the dental, you know, granted much less frequent, but again, you're talking about much lower doses from these full body scanners.
Now I have three questions from Tim Farley of whatstheharm.net. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, What's the Harm has collected the stories of over 670,000 people who have been injured or killed as a result of someone not thinking critically. It's definitely a fantastic place to send people who make statements like, oh sure, that's a silly belief to have, but really, what's the harm? Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't ask three questions from the same person, but these are all really great questions. So question one. Since this flap originated, I've seen a number of vendors selling shirts and underwear that ostensibly will produce a freedom-related message on the resulting scan. And for reference, these items have things like the Fourth Amendment printed on them, or they claim to keep your bits blocked from the camera. I'm dubious as to whether the vendor of these items has actually tested them with a real scanner, since the scanners are only used in airports. Can you confirm or deny if these products actually produce the desired effect on the display?
Well, short answer, no, I can't, because the TSA is supposed to delete the images right after they're used. So, in fact, it becomes like, and I love this, there are some people who like to, some figures. I know there was a yogi who liked to say that he was a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. It's non-falsifiable because they seal those records for 50 years, so you actually don't know who was nominated. So these images are deleted, so there's no way to know. But thinking about this, really, it depends what the physical resolution is and the density of the lettering. So they supposedly use some kind of, quote, metallic ink, of what sort of thickness, of what sort of atomic composition. Yes, metal does interact much more strongly with X-rays. It's something called the photoelectric effect. As you get to lower and lower energies, there's roughly 1 over a sort of a Z cubed, which is your atomic number, on the numerator, and a energy cubed in the denominator. So as your energy goes down, this effect goes up, and as your atomic number goes up, your effect goes up. So yeah, you know, this would be a place where that kind of thing would work. Now, the one image that I have seen released is one of the senior people in the TSA had an image of herself released, taken with one of these X-ray scanners. The resolution doesn't look that good. It would depend on the spot size, the spot size of the X-ray source, and would depend on the detectors. But I don't think the detectors are made for looking at the fine print. So I don't think you probably don't have enough metal. You wouldn't, you wouldn't have the fine resolution to see anything. If you did, they're deleted right away. If you go to the website, it's hilarious because what they show are not actually surface scans. They show X-rays with just these letters superimposed.
I noticed that.
So clearly there's no evidence it works. And I think people are just having, if you're buying it with knowing that this probably has no effect on anything, no one will see your message except you, unless you get pulled into the side room to strip down to your skivvies, no one's going to see it. It's just, if you think it's a fun thing to have, go to town. What's the harm? The harm is you're probably wasting your $50 or whatever it is they're charging for these underwear. And are you making a bold political statement? I could be making a bold political statement on my underwear too, and no one's going to know either. I guess, what's the harm? A fool and his money.
That's actually a t-shirt right there. I'm making a political statement in my underwear. I would wear that shirt. So question number 2. Some claim the X-ray source in that type of scanner is actually relatively high strength, but only doses the person a small amount because the scanner moves the source very quickly. Considering the fact that security employees are not generally medically trained like an X-ray technician, and they are not experts on these machines, what's the risk that the machine could malfunction in some way? For example, not move the source rapidly and overdose people?
Well, actually, Tim, that's a great question, and I alluded to that earlier. That's something that I subscribe to a professional listserv, and it's nobody would be interested except medical physicists generally. But one of the things that people have been obsessing over the last few weeks is, of course, the backscatter scanners. And the one thing that gets under everybody's skin, it seems, in the medical physics community is quality assurance. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know what quality assurance program they have. We don't know what sort of interlocks are present in the system. And there is that possibility. So supposedly the scan takes, I think I read, 3 seconds. And if you're doing a raster scan over the body, that source is going to be moving pretty quickly. And what if it does get stuck in one spot? Is the machine going to know? Chances are yes. How is that tested? I don't know. And that's a very good question. And I don't think that the TSA staff are trained as X-ray technicians. I don't know what training they do get with these scanners. Often when you buy equipment from a vendor, they will have a training course, and they'll probably bring people either to a centralized facility, or they'll fly out to do a site, a bit of site education. But I don't know if that's enough, and I don't know what program's in place to make sure these machines are safe. So I hate to sound like I'm sitting on the fence here, but are these machines safe? I can say probably, but... And there are other more complicating factors. But it's a good question. The machines should be tested regularly.
Question number 3. Aren't these machines easily bypassed by simply putting a bomb inside a body cavity? If so, what's the point?
Yes and none. So this gets back to the whole idea of it's the theater of security. The pat-downs, the surface scanning, and... You've got somebody who decides to, you know, is do what people do in drug smuggling. You know, swallow something and carefully plan things out with laxatives to pass it back out, or just insert things into a body cavity. There was actually a news story on at the end of September on the CBS website about a would-be assassin who had done exactly that. He inserted plastic explosives in his nether regions, and away you go. I mean, how do you find that? Cavity search. You know, it's I don't know if people are going to be willing to just keep taking it further and further. Is cavity searching the next thing? Full body CT scanning with, you know, transmission images.
You are freaking me out.
Well, you know, again, at some point we're I don't know what people are going to have to do to at some point say this is not useful. Another interesting thing to note is that El Al Airlines in Israel, they don't use the full body scanners. They're probably one of the most security conscious airports and airlines in the world. They don't use these full body scanners because for them, it's not worth it. They don't see the security value in it. So again, I'm coming away from my technical, you know, point, and this is a personal opinion, but I don't see the value, security value in these devices.
We could call that applied science, really, when it comes right down to it. Is the risk worth the benefit?
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you could say an evaluation can be done to say, you know, risk versus benefit, and risk, you know, even though negligible, benefit equals zero, you know, multiply zero by pretty much any number, and you wind up with a big fat zero.
So I realize that you've said it throughout the entire interview, but so in your expert medical physicist opinion, if we're going through a U.S. security point, then should we take the pat down? Or should we just consider this, you know, potentially an issue, but possibly overblown, and go through the scanner?
I'm still wrestling with that myself. I don't know. I've got a trip planned for next year. I'm going to be going through a U.S. airport, and I'm going to have to think about that. It's a funny thing. It's not completely cut and dried. I don't know how the skin dose has been evaluated. I don't know if it's been evaluated independently. And there are other issues around dose rate, dose, you know, the energy of the x-rays. You know, it's probably safe. But funny things can happen at low doses and low dose rates too, low doses and high dose rates. There's certainly some funny things that happen with, when we do radiobiology, we often look at cell survival curves. And incredibly small doses of radiation relative to the radiation dose size can actually be even more damaging. And some people theorize this is because you haven't stimulated the repair mechanisms yet. So the damage occurs, but doesn't get repaired the way it would at higher dose rates. So some people will say that's why in places like Ramsar in Iran, where they've got incredibly high background radiation, you don't see a lot of cancers, a lot of you know, cellular damage. And some people think that's because it's high dose, but low dose rate. Here we're talking about low dose, but high dose rate. So what's the effect? I don't think we really know for sure. And so some people, you know, have this attitude, well, you know, it's like they're conducting a vast experiment on the flying public. Well, that's a little melodramatic, I think. I think, you know, even if the effect is not as small as people would like to make it out to be, 10 times a really small number is still a pretty small number. So should you worry? It's not clear to me that you should worry. So I don't want to say categorically, don't worry about it. I would like to see more study done. But in the meantime, I wouldn't panic. You get a scan or two, it's probably not going to be an issue. But I think we as a society need to look at this and ask ourselves, is this really necessary? Are we gaining anything from it? Even if it is an incredibly small effect, is the small effect worth anything?
Mark, you haven't necessarily reassured me, but I very much appreciate you coming.
You're quite welcome.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes. And while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here today with Dr. Brian Goldman, host of White Coat Black Art on CBC Radio. He's been covering the Zamboni treatment for multiple sclerosis. Thanks for being here, Dr. Goldman.
My pleasure, Desiree.
So why don't you start by explaining what MS is?
Well, multiple sclerosis is a disease of the central nervous system that attacks the lining of the nerves called myelin. And myelin is, think of it as the coating of the electrical wiring that you have in your house. It provides insulation. It also facilitates the transmission of signals, nerve impulses through the nerves. And when you strip away the electrical wiring in the house, you get short circuits and you get appliances that don't work and lights that don't go on. In the same way, when you have demyelination or stripping of the myelin of the cells of the nervous system, you have poor nerve transmission. And in this case, you can get a whole bunch of symptoms, particularly inability to walk, weakness of the upper or lower extremities. Many people who have multiple sclerosis will suffer from periods of time when they're unable to walk. There's different kinds of multiple sclerosis. I'm not an expert in MS. They involve a rapidly progressive form. There is relapsing and remitting forms of multiple sclerosis where you get worse and then you get better and then get worse and then get better. There are others that are more rapidly progressive, but it's a condition in which you end up, unfortunately, many people who have multiple sclerosis end up in a wheelchair or worse, and they have difficulty walking because the disease attacks people, particularly women more than men. And it tends to attack them in the prime of life. The onset might be in the teens or 20s or 30s. You're taking people who are productive members of society, and they go from being able to be breadwinners to not being able to earn a living. Many of them have young children or children in their under the age of 10 or in their early teens, and they find that they're unable to do the kinds of things that most people can do as parents with their children. There are other symptoms that you can get, including eye symptoms. You can develop blindness. Often the blindness is temporary. Most neurologists around the world who are experts in multiple sclerosis would say the condition is a neurological condition that is caused by an abnormality of the immune system. The current prevailing theory amongst your average neurologist and academic neurologists as well, including researchers, is that multiple sclerosis is a condition in which the immune system, the one's own immune system, attacks the myelin, causing demyelination or loss of myelin and all the symptoms that I've talked about.
So how is it usually treated then?
It's usually treated with large doses of steroids, not anabolic steroids, but rather medications like prednisone or cortisone or solumedrol. These medications can reduce the inflammation. They're powerful anti-inflammatory drugs, they will be used in a pulse fashion. We call it pulse steroids. So if somebody comes into the emergency department with blindness caused by multiple sclerosis or an acute worsening or what we call an exacerbation of multiple sclerosis, they will receive a large dose of steroids. Now, in addition to that, more recently, there are medications that dampen the immune system at the molecular level. One of the most famous drugs is called betaseron. And betaseron is a medication that is related chemically to interferon, except it's a more specific medication that can stop the inflammation more directly at the cellular or molecular level to reduce the process of demyelination. And there are other drugs that are analogs of betaseron and other medications. These tend to be very expensive. They're not universally available in every province in Canada. They are not covered by every extended drug benefit plan. For many patients who have multiple sclerosis, they've been a godsend. they've allowed them to carry on a more normal life for longer periods of time. And very often these kinds of drugs can keep the symptoms of MS in check for long periods of time. However, there is no cure for MS, and some people, in spite of the best therapy that's available, will go on to develop rapidly progressive or relapsing and remitting or more slowly progressive forms of MS, and will end up in that wheelchair that so many people who have MS dread.
So what is the Zamboni treatment then?
Before we start with the Zamboni treatment, I think you've got to talk about the theory behind the Zamboni treatment. It was developed by Paolo Zamboni, and the hypothesis was put forward by Zamboni in the year 2008. The hypothesis, which is a very controversial one, has to do with the notion that Zamboni has promoted, that MS patients are highly likely to have blocked veins draining blood from the brain back to the heart. And the names of those veins are the azygos vein and the internal jugular vein. And he did a case series of patients back in that was published back in the year 2008. And he said that 90% of the patients he saw with MS had blockages, clots forming in the azygos and internal jugular vein. So he theorized that there were malformed or abnormal blood vessels, and that these abnormal blood vessels failed to drain blood from the brain back to the heart. So you know what happens if you have blocked veins in your leg. You end up with swollen legs. And so he theorized that you would end up with a swollen brain. The brain would be swelling with blood because blood would be unable to drain from the brain back to the heart. And blood is rich in iron, and he theorized that the brain would have increased deposits of iron, which in turn would trigger autoimmunity and degeneration or loss of that myelin that I was talking about. So the Zamboni treatment is basically an angioplasty. An angioplasty is a procedure that's done all the time in arteries. You know, if somebody comes to the emergency department with a heart attack, we do an angiogram, we inject dye into the coronary arteries, and if they are blocked, then an interventional cardiologist will put a catheter or a thin tube, usually through a vein in the arm or a vein in the groin, thread it up through the inferior vena cava, which is the big vein in the middle of the body, up to the heart, enter, you know, until the catheter tip reaches the coronary artery, squirt some dye into it, and if there's a blockage in a coronary artery, then through that catheter a balloon is inserted, the balloon is inflated, that's called an angioplasty, and that inflating of the balloon opens up the blood vessel, the artery. And then a stent, which is a kind of a wire mesh tube, is put into the tunnel that has just been re-expanded in order to keep it from collapsing again. And this is done all the time. It's done routinely. And there are many people walking around today who have a new lease on life when they have coronary artery disease causing angina and heart attacks. And they have a new lease on life because they have reopened coronary arteries, they get their energy back, they don't get chest pain, and if they're very careful, they can live a long time. And angioplasty has become a replacement for open heart surgery, coronary artery bypass, which was developed in the 1960s. So that's the procedure that Zamboni suggested doing in the veins, except not in the arteries, but in the veins that drain blood back from the brain to the heart. So the internal jugular vein and the azygos vein. And what Zamboni did was he published a case series of patients who had multiple sclerosis in which he did this angioplasty procedure. And as a result, he claimed that his patients would get better. Now, if you read the study carefully, not all of the patients got better. It was the patients who had early, sort of the first stage of multiple sclerosis, not people who had already advanced to a very severe state of symptoms. In fact, people who tended to relapse and remit also didn't improve. But in this one subset, he said that if you get them early and do the angioplasty and you can restore the blood flow to the through the veins so that the blood could drain better from the brain to the heart, as a result, patients would feel better. And certainly, if you read his anecdotal case series, he said the procedure was safe. He said that it seemed to be effective. He did not call it a cure, and he called for more study of the procedure, which is what you do when you launch, you know, when you publish a case series. A retrospective case series is biased. It's not well controlled. He was doing what some people call the MS liberation treatment, because it liberates iron from the brain, you know, liberates the blood flow. I prefer to call it the Zamboni procedure, because liberation sounds like it's liberating you, and it's got an emotional connotation that I think should be removed from the discussion. And, whenever you have a case series, you know, you publish 50, 60, 70, 80 patients who you claim have done well, you want to make sure, like, this is just a taste of what the procedure might do. There's always a call for more study, and what you want to do is set up a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial in which the patients won't know what treatment they got, and the doctors won't know what treatment they got. The doctors evaluating them won't know what treatment they got, because you want to eliminate any bias. You don't want to say that the treatment helped because you hope that it helped. You want to know that it helped because it worked better than a placebo. And Zamboni published his research in 2008, and from there, the results spread like wildfire throughout the world.
So has anybody else tested it at this point?
There are clinical trials that are underway right now. I'm not aware of any other clinical trials that have been published yet. There's no question that many countries have interventional radiologists. They are typically the ones who do this procedure, who have started doing the procedure because patients have asked them. Patients with MS have asked them to do it. So you've got physicians in Mexico, India, in Romania, in Bulgaria, in Poland, in Costa Rica, for instance, who have been doing the procedure because there are people with MS around the world, particularly in Canada, because we have one of the highest rates of MS in the world. And so they've been only too willing to do it. I'm not aware of any studies that have actually looked at the results in a controlled clinical trial. What I have seen are attempts by researchers to determine whether Zamboni's theory holds water. And one way to do that is to do a controlled clinical trial, an observational study, in which you want to see if it's true, if Zamboni's hypothesis is true, meaning is it almost invariably true that patients with MS have blocked veins, you know, azygos and internal jugular veins, whereas people who don't have MS don't have blockages in these veins. So in other words, they're trying to see if Zamboni's theory, so I'm aware of studies that have asked, that have posed the question whether Zamboni's theory is correct. Because, you know, if his theory is not correct, then there's no point in doing a study of the angioplasty procedure itself because the theory is not correct. And there are certainly groups of patients who do have blocked veins in there that are draining blood from the brain, but who do not have the symptoms of MS. For instance, dialysis patients, renal failure patients. Patients who have kidney disease who are on dialysis tend to have blocked veins coming from the neck, and yet they do not have any of the symptoms of MS. It's observations like those that have called Zamboni's theory into question. More recently, a study that was published in Sweden in the last few months demonstrated that there was no relationship between blocked veins and MS symptoms. And so you have at least one major study subsequent to Zamboni's that seems to have disproven Zamboni's theory, and there will be other studies to come. I think there's a total of 7 studies many of which have been paid for by Canadian Institute of Health Research, CIHR, which is the funding body that in September caused a furor amongst MS patients by deciding not to pay for research that actually did the Zamboni procedure.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking with Brian Goldman about the Zamboni treatment for MS, otherwise known as liberation therapy. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we help you plan your holiday gift giving with an hour on the best books about science. We're joined by a panel of former guests, including noisy astronomer Nicole Gugliucci, psychotherapist Dana Blumrosen, and writer-performer Kennedy Goodkey. They'll share their favorite science books and help you fill out your holiday shopping list, even if you're buying for yourself. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm discussing the Zamboni treatment for MS with Dr. Brian Goldman, host of CBC's White Coat, Black Art. So even though the treatment isn't offered in Canada, some people are going elsewhere to get it, and they're coming back with complications.
That's right. Any procedure that's invasive can have complications. Some of the complications include infections. Because you're doing an angioplasty, some of these complications are theoretical. We don't know if they're going to be true, but if they're going to turn out to be to happen. But you're talking about using angioplasty balloons that were designed to inflate arteries. Now, arteries are thicker walled; they're more durable than veins. So there's a real concern amongst my interventional radiology colleagues that blowing up or inflating that angioplasty balloon might actually rupture a vein. There's also the possibility that a portion of it will, if you put a stent, that tunnel that I talked about that's used very commonly with angioplasties used to open up blocked coronary arteries, that stent might migrate, and that happened at Stanford University Medical Center. Stanford was one of the few places in the United States that was doing preliminary work on the Liberation or the Zamboni treatment, and they had one patient in which they inserted a stent. So we'll talk about whether you should put a stent in or not in just a moment, but that stent migrated, it moved, and it headed towards the heart, which is where it's going to go because that's where the blood flow is heading. And, of course, that could have been very damaging to the patient. The other complication that's the one that we seem to be seeing is that after the Zamboni treatment is done, the patient goes home, claims to feel better, and then starts to feel worse and gets some imaging, some x-rays done of the neck, and finds that, unfortunately, the veins that were unblocked have become blocked again with blood clots. And that's the complication that we're seeing. Now, some of my colleagues in Canada have treated patients. I know one physician who has treated 20 patients who've had complications. At least one of them had a blood clot or blood clots in their lungs, so-called pulmonary embolus, directly caused by the procedure, because the procedure caused a blood clot in the vein. The blood clot traveled or propagated to the heart, and then the blood clots from the heart were fired off into the lungs, causing a pulmonary embolus. And I can tell you that a pulmonary embolus or a blood clot in the lungs can be fatal. In fact, I saw somebody and diagnosed them with pulmonary emboli, blood clots on both sides of their lungs, not related to the Zamboni treatment, but just on its own. And it's a good thing that this guy came to the emergency department and we treated him. So those are the kinds of complications that we've seen. Now, in addition to that, there has been one death of a Canadian who had the Zamboni treatment done in Costa Rica, came back to Canada, felt better, then felt worse, was found to have it was discovered by doctors here in Canada that the blood vessels in his neck had blocked off again. He asked for treatment. He called the clinic in Costa Rica where the first Zamboni procedure had been done. He was told that he should be put on clot busting drugs in Canada. And from what I understand about the situation, I have no direct involvement in the patient, but from what I've been told by other specialists who did have direct knowledge, he was told that he would not receive clot busting drugs in Canada because the doctors here didn't know that clot busting drugs would be a good idea, and were skeptical. In fact, were concerned that they might cause more harm than good. So the patient took it upon himself to return to Costa Rica, where he was given clot busting drugs and died soon after. So you not only have the potential for complications of the procedure, but the Zamboni procedure, but if you try to treat the complications, those in turn might have additional complications, some of which might be fatal. And in fact, we don't know right now, and most of my colleagues who are experts in doing angioplasties, It's called endovascular surgery. They tell me that they're not sure that you should treat clots that form in the veins in the neck, that maybe you should just leave them alone and maybe just put the patient on blood thinners to prevent the clots from getting bigger or new clots from forming, but not try to dissolve the clots. So there's a lot of unknowns here. And I think that's a very important point here, because a lot of members of the public, proponents of this procedure, have accused physicians in Canada of being unethical for not treating patients who have complications of the Zamboni procedure. And I want to make something really clear about this. It is definitely unethical for a physician in Canada to fail to attend to a patient in need. Whatever the reason for them being in need, they should attend to them, and they should use their best judgment and skill to try to relieve their symptoms and treat them. The problem here is that nobody knows for sure what to do with blood clots that form following the MSM bony procedure. So if you don't know what to do, it's hard to say that you're unethical for not following the advice of a colleague in Costa Rica or Bulgaria or anywhere else for that matter who says you should do this, because there is very little published evidence on the Zamboni procedure, on its complications, on how to manage them. And most clinicians that I know, most physicians I know, will practice what's called evidence-based medicine. And sometimes the best thing to do with a complication is to leave it alone. Once we have more information, more studies, then we'll know, you know, what the true incidence of complications is and how to treat them.
I received an email from listener Corey Albrecht, who had written to his local paper after a particularly unskeptical piece on the Zamboni treatment was published. And the piece that he was responding to framed it as a courageous, hopeful choice to pursue this treatment. So is that what you're seeing from the media coverage?
The media coverage treated from the get-go, from the beginning, from the first W5 report. It was Avis Favreau's report on W5. Tended to treat this as a heartwarming story, and it was a story, I recall, of love. Paolo Zamboni's wife has MS, and he was scouring the world for a treatment. And so it was a good story. On the other hand, you know, I think that since the W5 piece, there has been a tendency to promote the notion that patients are overriding the judgment and the wishes of neurologists who still think this is an immunological problem, when the proponents are saying this is a plumbing problem, this is a vascular problem. And in fact, one person said, I remember this in the media, you know, imagine if you're a neurologist who thinks that the problem is a problem with electrical wiring, and only to discover that MS is a problem of plumbing. So that they've hired an electrician when what you need is a plumber to fix the problem. And I would say that in general the media has tended to treat the MS Zamboni treatment, the whole story around it, uncritically, without very much skepticism. Now, having said that, you know, they were very quick to jump on the fact that people have had complications and one Canadian died, and so, you know, in that sense, they're following the story as it unfolds. I think they could have done a better job putting some of the early successes into perspective, into context, and we see this all the time. You know, if you look at Gary Schweitzer's website, healthnewsreview.org, you know, he is very good. He was a longtime investigative journalist, did a lot of health journalism, and helped to start the Mayo Clinic newsletter, and has become, you know, a beacon of common sense and putting some intellectual rigor into evaluating clinical studies and the media coverage of clinical studies. And he was a guest on our show, and he was decrying the lack of skepticism by mainstream media in greeting these success stories involving the MS Zamboni treatment.
So it's difficult to tell people who are really suffering that they should wait until the trials are done.
And if I had MS, if I had a family member with MS, I would probably feel the same way. although I would be, you know, as a doctor, as a physician, I would be very worried that somebody would, if they said to me, should I have the treatment, and I shrugged and said, I don't know, yeah, I guess so, and they went and had a terrible complication, and they took my word for it, because I'm a doctor, and doctors know everything, don't they? So I've, you know, we took a skeptical line on the show, on White Coat Black Art, in part because I think that, you know, we tend to react to the prevailing view. If the prevailing view is it's all positive, then our first thought is there must be something wrong. There must be something wrong with this picture. You know, we did the same thing for H1N1. You know, we actually named our show. You know, at the time when all the public health experts were warning about the dreaded second wave, we actually named our show Swinefeld, you know, after Seinfeld. We called it The Outbreak About Nothing. And yes, with all due respect and apologies to people who died, it was a very small number of people. And sometimes you've got to look at the evidence for what it is. And in the case of the MSM bony treatment, there is not enough evidence to say that we should be paying for it or that we should be doing it.
So you've recently published a book, The Night Shift, about your experience as an emergency room doctor.
My book is an hour-by-hour account of working a typical night shift in the emergency department. And, you know, I've had to change the identifying details of patients and juxtapose events that didn't happen beside each other. But it's still a very realistic look at what it's like to see patients and the kinds of characters that come in the middle of the night, the kinds of people who like to work night shifts, including me. And what I've done is I've pulled back the curtain and I've given people a ringside seat on the slide, you know, what goes on behind the sliding doors of the hospital, given the fact that 40% of us will spend some time in an emergency room in the next year. That's a lot of people. And so if you want to get the best out of the experience, if you want to know what really goes on behind the doors of the emergency department, then read my book. And one of the things I've done, you know, I don't want to give you the impression I'm just being critical of the MSM bony treatment. I'm critical of my colleagues. You know, I don't think that we practice safe enough medicine. And I've tried to be honest. I've tried to be honest about the obstacles of working nights, things like how difficult it can be to haul a specialist out of bed in the middle of the night, the games you have to play to make sure your patient gets looked after, dealing with sleep deprivation and what some of us do. You know, I take a medication called modafinil, which shift workers use to help them stay awake at night. I use it. It helps me stay awake at night. If somebody wants to say, oh, that pill-popping doctor, I don't care, because I think it's important that people understand that there's nothing physiological about working nights and that it's tough. And that we want to stay as sharp as we can, and we use whatever means that are appropriate and ethical to do. So I wanted to give people an honest look at how the practice of emergency medicine really goes, given the fact that so many of us are going to be there over the next year.
So how many people come in the middle of the night to talk about things like the Zamboni treatment or these other really controversial therapies?
Oh, you'll get people who do. I would say that the majority of people I see in the emergency department for symptoms of MS are having MS symptoms for the very first time. So they're having their first episode of arm weakness or their very first episode of blindness, and it's an incredible shock to them that they've got this disease. And you know what? Because we have one of the highest incidences of MS in the world, you're not going to go very long. You're not going to do too many night shifts before you encounter a patient with MS. It's rare that we see somebody who it wants to talk about the Zamboni treatment, given the fact that they're not going to come to the emergency department if they know they've got MS and they're getting worse on a chronic basis. They're going to come to the emergency department only if they have an acute exacerbation. So if they have a sudden episode of blindness, you know, or sudden episode of weakness of their arm, and usually we can treat them with pulse steroids, you know, a large dose of Solumedrol, and they usually feel better pretty quickly.
And where can people pick up your book?
They can pick it up on Amazon. They can pick it up at fine bookstores, independent bookstores. They can pick it up at Book City. They can pick it up at Chapters, Indigo, Kohl's, etc. And recently I signed a contract so that it'll be available on Kindle as an electronic book as well. And hope to have some news about an option for a possible TV series.
Brilliant. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here, Dr. Goldman.
My pleasure.
You can listen to Dr. Brian Goldman on CBC's White Coat Black Art, and there is a link to it on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we have one more brief interview. I'm here with Kim Hebert, occupational therapist and contributor to the Skeptic North blog. Thanks for being here, Kim.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So tell us what's going on.
Well, this year, Skeptic North decided to do something a little bit fun and have the 2010 Skeptic North Awards. And we'd like the readers to come to the blog and vote.
So now vote on what exactly?
They're going to be voting on two categories. And one category is the Canadian who best promoted critical thinking and scientific skepticism in 2010. And there's four nominees for that. And they're also going to be voting for the Canadian who least contributed to science, critical thinking, and held back any hope of helpful dialogue.
Inventive.
Yeah.
It's a long title, but I think it's apt. So is this kind of built off the weekly Skeptical Fails and Wins, the post that goes up every week?
It's based on interactions that the Skeptic North blog has had with certain individuals and also people who came out to sort of shine a little bit in the Canadian media over the last year, particularly people who in the least contributed category, particularly people who we've mentioned on the blog before. Dr. Magna Havas, the Trent University professor who's been promoting the electromagnetic field danger in the media. Also, Rodney Palmer, who has been part of that as well, banning Wi-Fi from Ontario public schools, trying to get that off the ground. There's also the Whole Life Expo. People who regularly read the blog, they might have already seen some accounts of some of the bloggers who attended that and what happened to them while they were there. And also Bryce Wild. He's a homeopath who's on TV regularly. He was also mentioned on the website before. I had examined 21 of his studies that he presented to me in a comment, and I took all those studies and examined each one of them, and his response was less than ideal, I guess.
You were very thorough. I do remember those. So who comes in on the helpful side then?
We have Rob Breckenridge. He hosts a radio show on Calgary's AM 770 CHQR. And he often presents science issues quite well. Dan Gardner and Jonathan Kay are on the list as well. They're both journalists, and they've also done well this year at dissecting conspiracy thinking, furthering the understanding of law, policy, risk assessment, things like that, that are interesting to skeptically minded people. There's also Dr. Lauren Trottier, who hosted the Lauren Trottier Symposium this year. This was a conference kind of thing that brought together some people like James Randi, Michael Shermer, Ben Goldacre to give talks.
So what's the point of all this then?
Well, the point is just to, you know, in one way have a little fun, but also to give some positive reinforcement to those who've done well, because often, especially in journalism, there's a lot of false balance presented in stories where, you know, there's not necessarily a controversy about something, but it's presented as if it is. And it's good to see some people taking the perspective of scientific skepticism on a particular topic.
So where can people go to find out more?
People can go to skepticnorth.com to the post, the 2010 Skeptic North Awards. And there's a poll at the bottom where they can vote for those categories.
Is there a cash award involved in any of this?
No, it's for bragging rights, pretty much. They're not going to get an award or monetary remuneration or anything like that. It's just pretty much for recognition, or in the case of the least contributed award, it's important to point out when views are not necessarily science-based or evidence-based, especially when they've become so rooted in the public consciousness, like, for example, the Wi-Fi getting banned from public areas.
Thanks very much for being here, Kim.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan. Woo, I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.